I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Eugene Jarecki. He is writer and director of the documentary The House I Live In, which opens this Friday at The Screen, which is on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And Eugene Jarecki will be here at 5:30 introducing the film and doing Q&A. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this film tells the story of the so-called war on drugs, which has a personal component for you. How did you come to make the film?
Well, you know, I grew up as any, you know, comfortable white American, aware to some strong degree as I grew older that friends of mine in the African-American community across this country, people I knew in places I had visited and people I knew growing up, were suffering greatly, that there was something blocking black progress, that after the civil rights movement, something seemed to be in the way of the kind of progress we anticipated for black people. I mean, my childhood, I didn't really understand the shape of this. But as I grew older and opportunities came my way that didn't come the way of people I'd grown up alongside, I was trying to find out what was in the way. The more I learned about it, the more it became clear that our criminal justice system, which is really a system of mass incarceration, particularly for black people, was really eviscerating the black community. And the question was why. And so that's what led me ultimately to an inquiry into the war on drugs, which produced that system of mass incarceration.
Drugs like opium and cocaine and marijuana and even heroin used to be legal, as we learn in your film. Before they were vilified, before they were made illegal, how were they used and by whom?
Well, you know, we have a long history, as it turns out, of drug laws in America that very often, when you look closely at them, had, you know, what we have in the past, deeply questionable, very often racist sub-machinations at work. The first drug laws we see in America were opium laws in the mid-1800s, which ended up really being laws that targeted Chinese immigrants. Opium was widely used in America by housewives and businessmen across the political spectrum and across the country, and yet we only made opium illegal in California. We didn't make it illegal across the country. We made it illegal where Chinese immigrants were coming, and we didn't make all uses of opium illegal, only smoking opium, which was the Chinese method for taking opium. So that very selective, targeted kind of law we saw used to then search, seize, detain, and harass Chinese immigrants who were, for example, seen as a possible threat to American jobs. But that was just the beginning. We've then seen drug laws of one kind or another, whether it was laws against marijuana or cocaine or other drugs over the years, even in Prohibition. We've seen how the law can be used as a kind of thinly veiled cloak over what is really a law about racial control or social control. And this has happened, of course, into the modern era with the tremendous disproportion with which crack cocaine, for example, became a targeted drug that allowed law enforcement to specially harass and ultimately detain and incarcerate black Americans.
Exactly. Whereas powder cocaine has 1/100th, or until recently had 1/100th of the penalty of crack cocaine.
Yeah, you know, crack and powder are the same drug. Contrary to what some people may think about it, it's the same exact pharmaceutical substance. The only difference is that crack is actually an adulterated form of powder because you add baking soda and water and heat to it. So here's a strange reality. If you are carrying crack cocaine and I'm carrying powder cocaine and we both walk down the street, if you have 5 grams of crack cocaine on you, for me to get the same sentence for carrying powder, I have to have 100 times as much powder cocaine on me to get the same sentence. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all, if for no other reason as well, that my powder cocaine, 500 grams of powder cocaine, is a giant crime. It's a huge street value. The street value of 5 petty little grams of crack is minuscule. And so suddenly the big crime, the big economic crime, the big serious crime in terms of how society should view drug crime, all of a sudden it is punished far more leniently than the much more minor crime. Well, over the years, experts told Congress that this 100-to-1 disparity was not based in science, made no sense, and was, of course, very destructive to the black community because crack was especially policed in black neighborhoods, and therefore when black people came into courthouses disproportionately, they then also faced disproportionate sentencing to their white counterparts. Well, Congress was told this repeatedly by experts, by judges, by medical and scientific and other experts, and year after year, Congress opted not to fix it, as if to say they didn't think it was broke. And so you do have an understandable charge of racism in the way in which crack laws were allowed to be so severe in contrast to powder cocaine laws, and the consequence has been an incredible explosion of African Americans in the prison system.
We're talking to filmmaker Eugene Jarecki about his documentary, The House I Live In. So what we have now is a situation in which untold billions of dollars have been spent on the war on drugs since the Nixon administration, and drug use hasn't gone down at all. In fact, the quality and availability of drugs has gone up. Why has this so-called war not reduced drug consumption?
Well, because at the end of the day, drug addiction, I mean, you're asking the perfect question. Drug addiction is a personal problem. It's a health problem. I mean, any of us who have a friend who's addicted, and which one of us does not have a friend or family member who has an addiction or ourselves are addicted to one thing or another, whether it's food or drink or shopping or gambling or whatever it is. When we hear of a friend who has addiction, is our first response, I'm going to call the cops? No. Your first response is to talk to the person to try to get them to understand that they probably need treatment, that they probably need some kind of intervention by compassionate action. And so a compassion-based approach is what we would recommend with any public health or any private health matter. And instead, this country has vilified drug addiction. And so the central issue that a person is struggling with something doesn't get met with the kind of compassion that's needed to fix it. Instead, it gets met with a throw-the-book-at-them approach. And what that does is it leaves the addiction untreated. And then it worsens matters by putting somebody, because of their addiction, into a compromised position of incarceration from which, if they ever emerge, they will emerge with now a major strike on their record, many steps back socially from where they may have even been before, having lost the ability to live in public housing, unable to get a job because they now have to tick a box on that employment application saying they've been arrested or convicted of a felony, and. So if the obstacles arise around them mount, and we've done nothing to solve the very problem they had to begin with. So now they have that problem plus a host of other problems, and then we're surprised that we have the highest recidivism rates.
Well, I think there's two things that need to be said in response to that. One of them is that not everybody who takes drugs is addicted to drugs, and yet many people still go to jail for that. And the other is that, as you point out so beautifully in the film, the economic situation and the entire lack of opportunity for so many people who are selling drugs makes selling drugs actually a rational choice in a place where there just aren't other opportunities or good educational system or anything like that.
Sure. I mean, you know, that's the thing about how warped we have become in the way we see this. I mean, we have, because we vilify drug use as kind of an easy choice, I think a lot of people, you know, there are people in this country who simply take drugs for recreational reasons. It's part of their pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Okay. That is something that, frankly, I think any democratic society should allow people to do. They should allow them to entertain themselves in the privacy of their own self and body and home and whatever else to their heart's content. Society is supposed to rely on law and law enforcement to protect us, one another, from crime, from rape, robbery, murder, the serious crimes where one human hurts another. But instead, what's happened is, by taking the prerogative to invade between the person and their body, the federal government has basically taken, I think, an invasive role. And by so doing, they end up having to paint with a very broad brush so that, you know, the nonviolent drug user in this country gets lumped in immediately with highly violent people. We have people in this country who are nonviolent people serving far longer sentences than the violent. I just participated yesterday in a tremendous victory in California, where I am right now, and I traveled here to pass what's called Prop 36. Prop 36 was meant to change California law, because California law is the three strikes law, and the three strikes law here is the most severe in the country. Under it, you currently have in California nonviolent people who, for a third offense that was nonviolent, got a life sentence, like stealing a slice of pizza, which literally got somebody a life sentence. Somebody else stole socks. Somebody else stole denture crane. Now, down the hall from such a person will be somebody who murdered somebody who might be out in 15 years. This senselessness, this inability to square a basic common sense in the law, thankfully compelled California voters yesterday to overwhelmingly, at almost 70%, vote to revise that law so that henceforth the third strike that would get you a life sentence in the state of California would have to be serious or violent, like we would all think the law should be. And so that is an example, I think a very beautiful example, of the way we can move forward from here and start to pull back the excesses in American law across the country. But it's a direct result of the way in which the drug war blurrily treats the nonviolent the same as the violent and makes us absolutely lose our moorings in terms of what law is supposed to do in society.
Richard Nixon turned out to be more progressive in terms of drug treatment when he fought this war on drugs. As you say in the film, two-thirds of the money appropriated for that so-called war went into drug treatment, not law enforcement, at least initially. But drug treatment doesn't fly politically, and law enforcement does. Why is that?
Well, Nixon is a really fascinating puzzle, and he's a case study in the American political discovery in the last few decades that tough on crime gets you elected, and it keeps you elected. P.S., I think this is changing. But for several decades now, ever since Richard Nixon ran as a tough on crime candidate in 68 and then ran again in 72 as a tough on crime warrior and won in a landslide, American politicians got the message that the way to get elected and stay elected is to sound tough on crime. I say sound because it's not actually tough on crime. It doesn't actually deal well with the crime, as we see from the embarrassing numbers that we have. We have a drug war now, thanks to Nixon, that is 40 years old. We've spent $1 trillion on it. We've had 45 million drug arrests. And what do we have to show for it? Nothing. Drugs are cheaper, purer, more available today than ever before, and used by younger and younger people than ever before. So the record of failure is so embarrassing that at this point, in many ways, you can look back to Nixon and say, well, actually, let's look at his actual policymaking. He taught us that though his rhetoric was tough on crime, he was actually smart on crime. He spent two-thirds of his drug budget on treatment, as you say, as opposed to law enforcement, because he knew the treatment worked. The bad thing you can say about Nixon is he knew better. He knew that he was being cynical and strategic with his rhetoric in defiance of what his actual policy experience was. The good news is we are now seeing the tragic results of that, and the war on drugs is something that almost no one will defend anymore. So we may be actually reaching a tipping point where you see Chris Christie weigh in against the war on drugs, Grover Norquist against the war on drugs, Pat Robertson recently criticized the war on drugs. They now have common cause with people like Danny Glover and Al Sharpton and Russell Simmons, people who've been fighting this for decades. Now, those who are concerned about the human rights implications have common cause with people like Grover, who don't think it's a good use of money, who think that it's an incredibly wasteful and invasive, bloated government program. So I think we may be on the mend.
We're talking to filmmaker Eugene Jarecki about his film, The House I Live In. There are so many people, as you say, in prison for nonviolent crimes at taxpayer expense. There's so many new prisons that have been built, so much money spent on law enforcement at various levels, from local to national, international. The financial cost, as well as the human cost, is enormous. Has the calculation ever been done what the economic effect would be if we legalized and taxed and regulated drugs, stopped paying for so many prisons, let that tax burden go, and let the nonviolent people who are in jail, many of whom you show in the film, and who are ordinary people who had no opportunity or made some mistakes or whatever, but let them go home and work and raise families. What's the calculation on that?
Well, you know, you need look no further than the example of a country like Portugal. Portugal is the case study, the poster child in the world of huge success, not in legalizing drugs, because they didn't, and I don't advocate that. I advocate decriminalization, which is what Portugal did. Sounds like a semantic difference, but it's not. In decriminalization, drugs remained a kind of controlled substance where the government takes more careful positions about what to criminalize and what not to. So Portugal decriminalized 10 years ago, across the board, all forms of possession up to a certain very large quantity, which when you get to that very large quantity, they assume you must be a dealer. And they maintained penalties for that as a kind of public threat. Then beyond that, they took the money that they saved, the incredible amount of money they saved by decriminalizing possession, and they instituted, with a fraction of it, one of the most robust drug treatment systems in the world, and also they instituted activities to destigmatize drugs in the way they had been taught to think about them as we have. That re-education and that reshaping of the treatment landscape in Portugal has produced incredible results. Every leading indicator in Portugal, social, economic, and political, has gone through the roof since this happened. HIV rates are down. Drug use rates are down. The workload in the criminal justice system is down. The savings is enormous. And the results in terms of public health and public safety are the model of the world right now. And so I would tell America that, yes, there are models where people have looked at the idea of reforming the American system, and they can visit our website at thehouseilivein.org to see some of this. You can enter your zip code and learn, you know, in New Mexico, who's fighting against the drug war and in what way. A good bit of my film was shot in New Mexico, so you'll also see, if you get to see the film, you know, in theaters or when it comes out elsewhere, you'll get to see that this is a film that portrays people on the ground struggling with this issue, and invariably, such as Marshall Curley, who's the Marshal of Magdalena, New Mexico, is a wonderful participant in the film. You know, what Marshall Curley talks about in the film is a system that is broken, in which people like himself try to make the most they can of the job they have in law enforcement, but they too want to see reform, and they pursue it in their own small ways. They pursue meaningful ways of having a more compassion-based, as Marshall Curley said, one-to-one way of dealing with their community. Well, this kind of example exists everywhere, both at the national level of trying to pursue reform, but at the local level of trying to become involved in your community and demand that we be smart on crime rather than tough on crime, as Marshall Curley is.
In your film, you feature one of my idols, namely David Simon, who's the creator of, I think, the greatest TV show ever made, The Wire. And to me, your film makes explicit everything that is contained in the stories that are in that program and the dramas that are in that program. And one of them is the complete erosion of trust between the community and the police in so many areas specifically because of the war on drugs.
Yes. David Simon is a national treasure, and getting him into my film was, you know, one of the best things that happened for the film, and it's built a wonderful friendship and an alliance between myself and David, and it means a great deal to me, and it means a great deal to the effort to reform the drug war, because David is a crucial fighter in that fight. What I think we found very common between us was an appreciation, and he has much more experience than I do, so in many ways, I'm a student to his teacher, but what we found between us was a clear and incredible demonstration of tragedy in the way in which so many of our policies and procedures in this country put profit before people. As David talks about in the film, he really looks at this as kind of capitalism's insatiable appetite for profit, ultimately being willing to compromise and consume poor people at the bottom of the economic ladder in America, who just are seen, as he says, as excess Americans. He looks at the camera at one point and he says, you know, if we're just going to jail these people and lock them up and basically profit off locking them up, why don't we just be more honest with ourselves? Why don't we kill the poor? We don't need these people. They're not helping our society, so why don't we just do away with them? And it's obviously a cynical remark meant to criticize a system that breaks David's heart as it breaks mine. I'm a child of Nazi German refugees, people who were Jews in Germany who fled the German experience, and I learned very well how societies can change and turn on defenseless groups within them and subjugate them to incredible destruction. David, also an American Jew, very aware of those issues and very aware of the need to be vigilant in any society about the way that society can go wrong. And what's happened in this society with our runaway form of capitalism, which tramples over anything in its path. And we don't mean mom-and-pop capitalism. We all want mom-and-pop running the shop on the corner. We all want that. What we don't want are monopolistic, predatory industries that target human beings as though they are the fodder for a profit machine. The prison industrial system in the United States is a profit-driven enterprise that relies upon a steady flow of our fellow human beings to survive. That is immoral. It's unchristian. It's un-American. And I think its days are numbered. And I plan to be a proud member of the army of people growing every day that are planning to fight to end the war on drugs.
Well, I think, and this was my take home from the movie, was these two intertwined roots of, on one side, this vast self-perpetuating kind of capitalist and government bureaucracy, like private prisons and the law enforcement industry and all the industries that serve them and so on. And the other is this attitude that some people are simply expendable, that their lives don't matter. And we've been doing this for, 300 years in this country? I mean, to say that something is un-American, I always feel a little bit ambivalent about that, because that's what Americans have been doing since the beginning, is crapping on immigrants or whoever.
Yeah, there's something about persecution that's almost as American as apple pie at this point. We are breakers of our own promise. At the same time, we also love our promise. We watched last night, and I remember watching the Obama family last night, and however you voted, I don't care. But I do care to say, here is an incredible family, four people who clearly have a glow of humanity and warmth and goodness in their eyes. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, there's no one in the Western world who doesn't think that about these people, other than Americans who've been so tortured by the pundits that they aren't even stopping to smell the roses, that with the Obama family, the American people actually delivered 4 years ago and then again yesterday. They delivered on that promise of America to be the place where people can get ahead, to be the place where you can see a multiracial society, a multiethnic society, a post-racial society, perhaps. But of course, it's always been a faltering promise in America. It's always not without its struggle. And I think the pride I take in the American story is I don't need to be a finished project that's perfect. I want to be a work in progress, as Roosevelt called it. And I think this work in progress has always been a struggle about our original founding ideals and the way in which our behavior over the years, whether through slavery or when women couldn't vote or with the pre-civil rights era or with Jim Crow or any of the other ways Japanese internment, we've always had flaws in how we grew up as a country. But we're a young country. We're an adolescent at this point at most. And so we have all the signs of youth. And as we work through those kinks, I cheer for this country because I think we work through them falteringly, but we progress. And with the drug war, I think it's another set of adjustments. You saw last night with Prop 36 in California and with legalization measures here and there in Colorado and in other states. You see in Massachusetts, you see with medical marijuana, you just see steps forward that are small but meaningful. And I think more broadly, I want the American people to take home the drug war is a dirty idea that's a thing of the past. These are like a dirty word. It should be put to rest, and we should move into a future where we do not have a war against our own people. We deal with compassion, and we try to make citizens, greater citizens of people who can then contribute, rather than the 6 million people we currently have under the control of the criminal justice system who can't vote, can't participate, can't contribute, and are simply just lost lives. And that's just not a moral way to be this country. So I have hopes that in our ongoing work in progress effort, we are making small steps, and I just want to add to them.
Do you think this whole situation with the war on drugs would be different if there were more working class jobs, a lot more working class jobs in this country? For example, all the manufacturing jobs that are no longer here?
Sure. I mean, David Simon points that out at one point, that when you see, you know, if you look at the drug war today, in the modern era, the disproportionate target of law enforcement and our criminal justice system has been Black Americans, no question. And my film explores how and why that happened. Crack laws and other are just part of the picture. There's a long story to why Black Americans became such a disproportionate focus of our legal system. But what's happened now in the more recent past is that as more and more Americans are becoming poor, as the American economy is challenging more and more people, you find that more and more people are finding their way into not just drug use and abuse, but also into the vulnerability to law enforcement that they are poor, most often using and dealing in public spaces, in what was housing projects for Black America is now trailer parks for white America. And you find that there is a growth pattern in white people, in women, and in Latinos, that Black people still are the disproportionate focus of the system, but the growth areas, the areas where you see real trending, are among white Americans, Latinos, and women. Now, those white Americans represent a new kind of demographic of this is how the drug war has moved in many ways from race to class. What it basically does is prey upon poor people who, A, find themselves in positions of vulnerability both to drugs and to the law enforcement against them, but B, those people also then, when they do get put in a courtroom, for example, they can't get a good lawyer. They don't have the defenses that you or I might have. And so they become these statistics of the increasing pressure upon poor communities in America by the system of the war on drugs.
Eugene Jarecki is writer and director of the documentary The House I Live In. It opens at the Screen, which is on the Santa Fe University of Art and Design campus. And on Friday, November 9th at 5:30, Eugene will be here with us in Santa Fe. The website is thehouseiliveIn.org. Eugene, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Tess Young. She is a dancer, an organizer of all kinds of things, a former bodybuilder, and she's here to tell us about an event that is happening this Saturday, the 10th of November at 7:30 at the Scottish Rite Temple. It's called Sacred and Sensuous, and it is a benefit for Burmese orphans.
Yes.
Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Mary
My
Charlotte.
My pleasure. Now, how did you, first of all, get involved in the nation of Burma and helping the children there?
Yeah. You know, I had an opportunity to travel in 2008. I took a little break from nonstop working and studying and pursuing my career as a bodybuilder and TV person and theater, and I've done a lot of things, and you know, I just look at my life and I'm like, man, I need to take a break. And then timing was impeccable, and my husband, who I met in 2007, have traveled to Asia for over 35 years. He knew a lot about Asia, and I always had this curiosity about it, but never been to. And I'm from South Korea. I don't know much about Southeast Asia. I only hear about it. I had a particular interest in Burma because of their political condition. You know, their totalitarian, their junta. And my mother is from North Korea. She escaped when she was very young. Due to it, she lost her brother and parents early. So I hear all these stories, and then I hear about Aung San Suu Kyi, and then it's like, I need to go there. I need to see this country, what's going on. And then I read a book called The Voice of Hope by Alan Clement, who is a friend. He's been a monk in Burma for about 9 years. And I saw Burma VJ. You know, I cry. It hurt me very deeply, that documentary. But there was some urgency inside of me that I have to see this country. We were very, very fortunate. Our friend Alan Clement said, we can connect you to meet the lady, Aung San Suu Kyi.
So you met her?
We met her in her home. We were invited, 54 University Avenue in Rangoon. There were two military cars in sunglasses sitting in the car, watching every activity around her house. So they even saw us going in. Last year we tried to go again. I couldn't go in. Maybe our name's on the list now. Who knows? You know, they know everyone who sees Aung San Suu Kyi, basically.
And so what was it like to meet her, and what did you talk about?
You know, it's funny because me and my husband, like, oh, what should we ask? You know, like, we talked about, oh, you know, we're so nervous to meet, you know, the great beings, like meeting Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King or Gandhi. I never met any of them, but I have a chance to meet Aung San Suu Kyi, national hero. So we thought about what we're going to ask, but actually when we got there, she had a little dog start humping me. So it broke the ice immediately. And then we forgot about what we're going to ask. And then we walked in, and then all National League of Democracy people were there greeting us, and we met Aung San Suu Kyi. And then, you know, just very, like, she was like a lady next door. Very warm and, you know, friendly, and but very dignified and upright kind of posture. So we sat down, and we just talked about how it has been for her, being house detention, and we asked a few questions, but she was very careful because they are recording. Actually, military junta can hear everything we talk about in that room.
Right.
So she was very selective in her words, and then we immediately say, okay, we're not going to ask anything that will put her in a difficult situation. So, you know, we talked about her family, and then I talked about her daily routine, you know, how her day's like. And she say, oh, you know, I get up at 4:30, I exercise for 1 hour, and then I listen to BBC, and then I eat my breakfast. You know, kind of like real casual, normal conversation. And then we asked her, how can we serve you? Because my husband has a lot of friends who's doing a lot of philanthropic work, activist work. So we wanted to know, what is she needing? And she said to us, help our children. They need help.
What kind of help did she mean?
You know, she said that she would love her young adult to able to experience democracy. Because they have this pro-democracy movement. But all these kids, young kids that are following her and National League of Democracy members, they never experienced them. So they just know in theories, whereas she experienced it in England.
She experienced democracy, and she wants them to. So yeah. Then what did you do after that? What did you decide to do next?
So, you know, after that, you know, we came back and, you know, we try to actually post some friends that who can have a college program. My husband was trying to, you know, work on that. You know, if we can bring some Burmese kids then put it in the schools. And, you know, that was one area he tried to work on. But it was very difficult, really. It was very difficult to do. And then my part was I went to orphanages in Burma. And then I look at these little kids, and then a lot of them lost parents due to military conflict, force against their family. A lot of them, their parents went to jail and got killed. Or, you know, they're tribal fighting.
Right.
They kill each other. They lost a lot of parents, a lot of kids.
And this is something you resonated to because your mother was in that position.
And that too. And it's just when you see it, how can you not? You're there. You see this kid, Hill tribal, Pao tribal children. They're so beautiful and they're so naive and they need so much help. And then, of course, is my mother is from North Korea. She lost her parents. And, you know, I have that precondition, you know, hearing about North Korea most of my life, growing up in 18 years in South Korea. So there is that resonance, too. But I think it's beyond that. I think I just felt it in my gut. It's like, if I can do something to help these kids, I want to do that.
And so now you were doing an event, Sacred and Sensuous, which is a sacred dance and music concert to benefit orphans of the world. Every penny of it goes to benefit these orphans.
Yes.
in Burma.
Yes, Burma and also some Tibetan refugee children also, because okay. I happen to travel there, and I'm helping one monastery, one nunnery in Lomantang. There's Upper Mustang, northeastern side of Nepal, on Tibetan plateau. So there are about 200 children who are needing help. I met all the village people. I went to daycare center, school. So I like to help them also. And because I was in Nepal, Kathmandu, I went to this another orphanage called Child Haven International that is run by Mahatma Gandhi's philosophy. So I'm actually helping about right now three orphanages and then some Tibetan refugee children who need help. And I'm in New Mexico, so I have to help some good work in New Mexico, too.
So meanwhile, you're doing this concert, and you've gathered together so many different artists.
Yeah.
Tell us about the kind of things that people can expect. I mean, there's a lot of different events within this concert.
Yeah.
Different kinds of dance.
Yes.
From Middle Eastern dance, and
yeah.
You're going to be performing
Korean fusion, sacred
yeah.
dance. Yes. The reason why I wanted to do it this way, to give people taste of, you know, all different sacred practice. You know, when I look at this lined up, I don't look at them as entertainers. They are sacred practitioner. They have their practice in their body. They've been doing it for a long time. This is how they keep their heart nice and soft, the spirit light. So I wanted to show people there are this kind of different kind of entertainment. So first one is me. Second one is a Sultana dancer. Third one is very interesting, Satori hoop flow. So these two girls gonna do hula hoop, and they're gonna connect towards the source that's higher than them. That's their practice with a live harp, drum and piano, all live. Next vignette is our oldest dancer, Betty Robinson. She's 76 years old, and you'll just enjoy her storytelling through her movement. And next one is Echo, contemporary dancers. They dance at Lenzik with Robert Wood. They just finished performing.
Oh.
They do beautiful vignette. Heather McDonald, she's one of the best tribal belly dancers of New Mexico. She'll do her solo. And next one is contortionist, Laura.
Ah, yeah.
You've seen her.
I've heard about her, yes.
She is just so beautiful. So she will do her solo called Mused, this title. Consuela Luz.
Musician.
Yeah.
Songwriter.
Yeah. She's doing sacral sounding, second chakra healing sound with Lara Bodge. She's a yoga dancer. She's a yoga teacher. And next one is Harvest Moon. It's kind of more live piano and interpretive dance. And on.
Yeah, yeah. lots of different kinds of dance. Now, you've lived in New Mexico just a few years.
Let's see. I moved here in 2010. July, we came here to visit.
Right. And then you stayed here. Now, are you doing dance here? Are you studying? Are you teaching?
You know, I have private clients, and I'm new in town, so I like to be a student. So I've been taking circus performance with Wise Fool. I go to People Moving Dance, do modern dance there. I'm studying right now belly dance with the Sultana dancers. So I'm tapping into all different classes to see who's teaching. Before I teach, I like to just be a student for a while.
So this sacred dance and music concert benefiting orphans of the world is called Sacred and Sensuous. You can find out more information by going to sacredsensuous.com. And it is Saturday, the 10th of November, at 7:30 in the evening at the Scottish Rite Temple. For those who don't know what that is, it's the big pink building on Paseo. Tess Young, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, and then also we have a free hors d'oeuvre. Don't forget that. Silent auction.
Yes.
And
hors d'oeuvres
and
silent auction.
And I'm showing my documentary from 2008 to 2011.
So should people get there earlier than 7:30?
No, 7:30 is good because 7:30 to 8:15 people mingle and, you know, silent auction. And the show starts like 10:15.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Tess Young, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Pamela Michaelis. She's president of Ensemble Music New Mexico, also known as Chatter. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you, too. So what is Chatter?
Okay, Chatter is a music organization that is dedicated to classical music, but it's a weaving together of traditional classical music and contemporary classical music in a way that makes both of them make, at least to my mind, more sense. There's a saying that all music was once new, and it's absolutely true. David Felberg and James Shields are our artistic directors. David Felberg is known to this audience especially because he is the concertmaster of the Santa Fe Symphony.
Yes, and a very good violinist.
He's a fabulous violinist, and I think fairly beloved in this community.
Indeed.
As an artistic director, his vision is youthful, but it's also seasoned, because he's not a baby, but he's not an old guy either. I've never actually seen anyone put together programs like David does, and he makes people very comfortable with contemporary classical music, because he then turns around and delivers brilliant performances of traditional, the work that people really are comfortable with and they go to bed with.
Right, and so this coming Friday night, actually tomorrow,
right,
is a concert here in Santa Fe, the New Mexico Museum of Art. It's a collaboration among Chatter, the New Mexico Museum of Art, and the New Mexico History Museum, and I think it's at the St. Francis Auditorium.
It is indeed.
And so at 6 o'clock in the evening, now you are having quite a variety of music this Friday night.
Right.
Including, what is it, a world premiere?
It is a world premiere. Mary Charlotte, this is a very big deal for a little organization like ours. A couple of years ago, we decided that we wanted to commission Roberto Sierra to do a piece for us for two reasons. One, it would come out in just in time for the centennial of the statehood of New Mexico. And secondly, Chatter is about to have its 10th anniversary. So we thought, what a great timing, you know, for us to have Roberto Sierra. We chose Roberto Sierra. Here we are, this tiny little organization. Roberto Sierra is a very important figure in the music world. But nonetheless, we thought, there's no harm in asking. We decided on him because he has been to New Mexico often. His work and he have performed with the New Mexico Symphony Orchestra when it was live. I believe he is a friend of the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival.
Yes, indeed. We had him on this show a few years ago when he was here.
Oh, fabulous, fabulous. I had forgotten about that. So, you know, he, I think, loves New Mexico. New Mexico loves him. He is an artist that our artistic directors, David Felberg and James Shields, they loved his aesthetic, and they thought, okay, he will write something that's going to be really challenging for us and that's going to be very cool for us. And so they said, our core group is a violin, which is David Felberg, clarinet, which is James Shields, flute, which is Jesse Tatum, who also performs with the Santa Fe Symphony. Cello, James Holland, and piano. And for the pianist, it's a young man named Danny Spiegel, who is a friend of Chatter, a very good friend of Chatter, who's a wildly wonderful pianist, who also works as a public defender in Charlotte.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's quite a tale. And he's young.
Yeah.
So, but in any case.
So you said to Roberto Sierra, here are our musicians, here's what they play, write us a piece.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
And you haven't heard it yet, of course, because it's a world premiere.
I have not. David Felberg said to me, and I wrote this down.
And we're sorry he can't be here today, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, it is.
He's a busy guy. He's rehearsing a world premiere.
He's rehearsing a world premiere and these two other massive, big things. And it's so he's not here, but he will be listening. Anyway, he said something about, he said Roberto Sierra's Caprichos lives up to its name as a whimsical virtuoso tour de force.
And that's the piece that we'll hear.
That's the piece that we'll hear. And I'm excited to hear it.
Excellent. So the other pieces are by Schoenberg and John Adams. Now, Schoenberg, lest people go screaming out of the room as they hear this, has composed some incredibly accessible, tonal, beautiful, complex music.
That's exactly right.
Is this one of those?
Some of it. It is Schoenberg. It is a classic piece. It was written, David chose it for a couple of reasons. One, it was written precisely 100 years ago. So we have these two bookends of the Schoenberg and the Sierra.
To celebrate New Mexico's centennial.
Exactly. And as I was reminded by James Keller, who's a great music critic in this town, the Piero Lunaire is a classic, and people should not be afraid of this piece of music. It is definitely Schoenberg, but it is so complicated. It's got all kinds of interesting things. Instrumentally, there are there's this piece for a soprano who sings the entire piece as Pierrot, even though it's a soprano. She's singing as Pierrot.
Tell people who Pierrot is.
Pierre Lunaire, boy, it's sometimes called Moonstruck Pierrot. And he is a young creature who is both the hero and a fool. He goes through life in high drama. Okay, and there is pain and misery and sex and drugs and God knows what else going on in his life.
Well, according to your program, love, sex, religion, disappointment, crime, blasphemy, and finally going home to the old perfume from fabled times.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and he's this young creature going through that enormous lifespan. I have never seen Pierrot live. I have listened to it probably 125 times.
Oh, my goodness.
Coming up to this. And each time I hear it, I love it more. The first time I heard it, I thought, oh, my gosh, this is kind of challenging. But then I listened to it again and again, and I heard so much in it because it is a complicated and beautiful, dense piece of music.
We're talking to Pamela Michaelis from Chatter about the Centennial Concert, which is tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. And the third piece is John Adams' Grand Pianola music.
Right. Oh, my Lord.
And we're going to hear a little bit from that.
Yes.
At the end of
this segment. We're going to hear a little bit of this. It is massive. It is an industrial strength ensemble. There are no strings in this piece. There are winds, brass, percussion like crazy, three voices, and two pianos. So it's dueling pianos. It's this sort of sure-footed determination and resolve. And then it goes off into moments of extreme delicacy. John Adams is brilliant. Some people have called him the most important American living composer. There are all kinds of hyperbolic things about John Adams. He's brilliant, he's eloquent, he's funny, and I think this piece is going to lift people out of their seats because it's really exciting. And Mary Shadda, I have to tell you this one tale. I've been looking for a variety of things, including music stands for our musicians. And I thought I had plenty. I had 25 or something like that, till we asked the percussionist, Jeff Cornelius. So there will be three percussionists in this piece. And I said, how many stands will you need? And I thought he'd probably say six. He said 16. Why? Because these three percussionists are going to be spread out, I think, in an arc, I'm not sure, and they'll be moving. They'll be moving from one thing to the next. So 16 stands, we've got them.
All right. So tomorrow night at the New Mexico Museum of Art, St. Francis Auditorium, and it's a collaboration among the New Mexico Museum of Art, the New Mexico History Museum, and Chatter. And you have all sorts of other events going on. And in fact, people can find out more by going to chatterchamber.org. But you've got a packed set of events between now and the end of the year.
We like to say our season never ends. We will perform about 65 live concerts a year, which is stunning. It is every Sunday morning we do a performance at a place in Albuquerque called The Cosmos. It's really informal. It's very intimate. But it is high-quality, professional, exciting music every Sunday morning. It used to be called Church of Beethoven.
Oh, I went to some of those Church of Beethoven things.
Okay.
They were fabulous. That's, sometimes there was poetry.
There's always poetry, 10 minutes of poetry.
And is there poetry this Friday, tomorrow?
No, only at the Sunday morning, only in the Sunday morning concerts.
Ah, okay.
But so we lost the name, and we decided, why not just make all of what we do called Chatter? Makes it easier on us and everything else. So, and yes, and we will do a monthly evening concert in downtown Albuquerque at the Hotel Andalus in a black box club-like atmosphere. So it's sort of the same as Sunday morning Chatter, except that it's in the evening with alcoholic beverages and tapas instead of coffee and goodies.
So you can make reservations and you can just show up at 6 o'clock. Now, there's a thing beforehand.
There is a thing beforehand, and it is a reservation only. The wonderful gallery Patina offered us a pre-concert reception, and that is, obviously, we can only have a limited number of people. But people can go to our website, chatterchamber.org, and find information about that and give us a call or an email, and we can get them into the pre-concert reception as well.
And that's from 4 to 5:30 at Patina Gallery, which is on Palace Avenue, so that's right nearby.
That's right.
Just a very few steps to the museum.
That's
well,
right.
Pamela Michaelis is president of Chatter, which is also Ensemble Music New Mexico, and we will see you tomorrow night.
Yes.
And let's go out with music of John Adams. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.